the moment. What's going on?
Think of some of the biggest moments in our modern history.
As a gay man, you have changed my life.
We bring together the people that were the centre of those stories.
I didn't use the word undermine. I talked about the changing social meanings of marriage.
To relive it. And in a way, we relive it too.
The Daily Papers called us the Dolly Dribblers of England. What did your boyfriend think of you playing football?
The new series of The Reunion with me, Kirsty Wark. Available now on BBC Sounds.
Now on Radio 4, Simon Evans flies the flag for Tinkering in the Shed with his comedy on economics, which this week focuses on invention and innovation.
Hello and welcome to Simon Evans Goes to Market, the final episode of this series. In the first three episodes of this post-pandemic appraisal, and yes, I am saying post, it's over now, that's enough, we looked at three areas of concern: the devastation wrought on our high streets, the upwards transfer of wealth into the hands of the super rich, and the challenges facing the performing arts as they try to ease open their doors. But this week, I want to switch to positive mode, to embrace the opportunities that the post-COVID, post-Brexit boom might present. It seems to me that the present government might have an unusual and unanticipated chance to map out a vision for where Britain goes next. Winston Churchill wrote that there is nothing more exhilarating in life than to be shot at without result. Our Prime Minister, inching ever closer to a passable peacetime pantomime of his hero, can now legitimately claim to have experienced something akin to dodging a bullet too. Boris Johnson did very nearly die last year, of course, unless you believe the ventilator truthers. But the bullet I'm referring to is an allegorical one, whereby any possible economic damage done by Brexit has been obliterated by the asteroid crater left by COVID-19. Instead, 2021 provided an almost immediate and incontrovertible benefit of our new freebooting identity in the shape of millions of squat little glass ampules trundling off on thousands of tiny milk floats, not to Berlin, Paris, or Brussels, but to the good old NHS. Our ability to secure advantageous vaccine delivery schedules was not an issue, I think it's fair to say, foremost in the mind of Leave voters in 2016. But it all counts, and as it all fell into place, Bojo must have felt that he had not only dodged a shower of bullets, but had been granted Neo in the Matrix-like abilities to watch them pass harmlessly by his head like a shoal of airborne mackerel. Indeed, looking at his ratings rise inexorably, despite everything from his missus' taste in wallpaper to one of the highest death tolls per capita of any Western nation, or indeed Eastern nation, or undiscovered fictional, hypothetical, or mythical nation on Earth, he must wonder if he is living in a simulation created solely for his pleasure. Is he slumped on his back on a sofa amidst a heap of crisp packets and biscuit crumbs, having actually lost the leadership election in 2019, and wearing a high-end VR headset, now enjoying an alternative reality in which the rest of us are all non-player characters, not just the obvious ones like Keir Starmer and Beth Rigby from Sky, but all of us? How long before he stops attempting to deflect Starmer's forensic critiques of his latest outrage with stammering, kerfuffling verbosity, and instead simply stretches out his hand into a podgy claw and effortlessly channels the force to elevate his hapless adversarial irritant several feet into the air before gesturing him back onto the vacant bench behind him, or possibly Angela Rayner's lap? Boris Johnson has operated in this mode for as long as anyone can remember, using Steve Jobs' notorious reality distortion field, only with more Latin. His wayward journey down the bowling alley of his career has repeatedly bounced out of the gutters of ignominy and disgrace and back onto the camber of public approval, though whether by the invisible sausage cushions of destiny or the infuriating idiocy of the electorate is a matter of dispute. Johnson is Teflon, Kevlar and Scotch Guard, not just rolled into one, but shaped and stitched into a soft toy, clearly on the verge of a product recall. But as long as it holds... as long as it holds, and currently it looks like the only realistic prospect of him being brought down would be an army of resentful offspring appearing like fire ants overwhelming a backpacker with a twisted ankle, it does represent a unique opportunity for radical action. So, what should he do with this momentum? Like every other leader in the free world, build back better, he says. A recovery with feminine characteristics, he suggested recently. What is that exactly? A recovery that gently murmurs, don't worry about it, it's fine, it happens to everyone, as the country looks mournfully down at its lingering recession. Is that the blue pill? Is that the blue pill we're being offered here? But what are we to build back better? Little Britain? Airstrip 1? A pirate ship moored off the coast of Normandy? A string of shining new Shanghais? Magnets for bankers, would-be Pacific rimmers and other rent-seeking parasites? Or something a little quirkier and more truly British? My sense is that we need to foster a culture of innovation, but with British characteristics. Remember, they may have invented Facebook, Google and TikTok, but we invented programming, artificial intelligence and the World Wide Web itself. We did this by tinkering. We are a nation of tinkerers, hobbyists, gifted amateurs. The Ada Lovelaces, Alan Turings and Tim Berners-Lee of this world all had something of the lovable eccentric to them, as did the Magnus Pikes, Heinz Wolfs and Johnny Balls, who communicated the love of science to our kids. We need to bring back the shed. We need to bring back long, rainy afternoons without any online distraction. In a word, we need to bring back boredom. If there is one thing... If there is one thing I associate with my childhood, it is the yawning chasm of the Sunday afternoon, the utter desert of time stretching before me, devoid of stimulation. Songs of praise used to come on the TV at 6 o'clock in the evening and lighten the mood. But as a consequence... As a consequence, I amuse myself with tinkering, Meccano, Lego, something to do with straws, and in the process, developing many of the ideas that eventually made possible the viability of today's offshore wind farms. Sadly, I never shared those ideas and have now to accept that my role is likely to be ignored by history. But never mind, it was fun. We need to bring back wet 1970s weekends, salad cream sandwiches in front of Going for a Song, accompanied by your sleeping nan's whistling nostrils, was enough to get anyone heading for the spare room workbench. The fact is, of course, many people today have barely outdoor space at all, let alone sheds. We need to repurpose unused offices, retail and industrial space, and pubs left destitute by latte-sipping metropolitans, all broken up into small units, free of business rates, for innovators. Access would be via a Dragon's Den-style presentation to a board of proven tinkerers. Perhaps name it in honour of the Duke of Edinburgh. And once a year, a lookalike goes round and ejects the ones he thought were nonsense. Get out! The world doesn't need any more artisan dog treats. Where's that chap with the home still? Get him in here now. Tinkerers need a network too, of course, between stretches of deep thought and pipe smoke and a space to share their ideas, because their parents don't care and their friends think they're weird. The app names itself. Tinker will be the brainstorming equivalent of Tinder. It lets you know when there are people nearby who you can run ideas past or who want to pitch something to you. And through use, each user will gradually acquire a detailed rating. Inspirational, thorough, obsessive, bullshitter, fantasist, actual motive is sexual, etc., etc.
Well, so much for my views on tinkering. But what might a real inventor think? I decided to speak to Professor Lucy Rogers, who describes herself on her website as an inventor with a sense of fun. That sounds like tinkering. Lucy, can I ask you, is a sense of fun an important element in the process of invention?
Well, it is for me. I really enjoy just playing around and tinkering. And if someone's got a fun problem, I'm really curious of how I can solve it. And the great thing with fun and maybe flippant projects is the underlying science or engineering is actually applicable. So grab someone's attention with the fun and flippant and take that bit of engineering or science and apply it in the real world to an actually important problem.
Interesting. This is encouraging. So in the shed scenario that I've been discussing, either literally a garden shed in your own garden or possibly sort of workspaces being created out of post-industrial units, that sort of thing, what kind of setup would you recommend to people if they want to sort of start tinkering and possibly creating something? Is it worth having a soldering iron? Do you need to have electronics? Do you need to have one of those tanks with the big rubber gloves in so that you can mess around? Yeah. What kind of level of equipment do we need?
Well, it all depends on what you're trying to do. I mean, you can start with just coding, and so all you need is a computer. Then moving on to electronics, and so a cheap soldering iron, and you can now get USB powered soldering iron, so you could actually plug it into a USB plug and start right. soldering. And that's a wonderful skill to acquire somewhere along the line. And just even things like assembling the furniture, you know, you get flat pack furniture, and just assembling that and seeing how it goes together, and can you use the hammer. And so you don't need the more expensive things, the 3D printers, the laser cutters, although they are fun.
I think if you could invent a better system for putting together flat pack furniture, the world would definitely beat a path to your door. So do you think in the modern era, realistically, do any meaningful inventions emerge from the amateur end of the spectrum, from the tinkering end, or is it all coming out of either Silicon Valley or massive sort of university departments?
No, they definitely come through the tinkering bit. We don't hear of the inventors when they are part of a company often, but there are an awful lot of ways that you can get your product to the market now through Kickstarter or whatever. So it's really good. And there's a scheme in Germany called Jugendforscht, which is actually youth researchers. And from that, they do it when they're about 14, 15, and their education system's slightly different. So they've got a little bit more time at that age to do science projects. And they've had patents come out of that from these 14, 15-year-olds. So there's definitely scope there.
It's interesting. I mean, I've been wondering what we could do in the UK to encourage the next generation of inventors and to make it seem like it's a fun, possibly glamorous thing, possibly kid them that there's a lot of money involved. Is there some sort of way of urging them forward with the adoption of a good song, perhaps a friendly furry mascot of some kind?
Oh, if it was only a song and a mascot, that would be absolutely wonderful. I think there's a lot of cultural shift needs to change where, you know, we see inventors as boffins with fuzzy hair and glasses and lab coats and generally old men in their sheds tinkering. And that's not really a good image. It's not what children aspire to be. But when we can actually see we are solving problems, we are solving people's problems, that really helps.
This vision of distributed suburban creativity might disappoint those who want to see the UK mimic the corporate models of Silicon Valley or the Asian Tigers. But I was never convinced by the Singapore on Thames thing. It sounded to me much more like a middle-aged man's fantasies of a Thai bride rather than a viable economic model. And I say, be careful what you wish for. While San Francisco is fast becoming the very definition of a modern dystopia, with the middle class all but gone and wealthy tech elites stepping gingerly over comatose fentanyl addicts and flybone bubonic corpses on the way to work, the city-states of the Pacific Rim have struck another Faustian pact for economic success and basically gelded themselves for gold. Singapore has a fertility rate of just 1.2 children per woman. Hong Kong's is 1.07. And in Seoul, the paradigm of unfettered growth, it is 0.64. This is a level of reproduction historically only seen during not just war, but a long drawn out siege when the diet of tin food and eventually pets has an understandable effect on the libido. It is below the level that would be considered acceptable in a prison, convent, or even some Catholic high schools. And these nations... these nations have all fallen from producing 5 children per family just 70 years ago. I suspect that the urge to recreate yourself in miniature cannot entirely be replaced by fur babies and photo face apps. I am sure this childlessness is a source of some frustration and sadness. And I suspect it might just provide the UK with the market opportunity of a lifetime. No, not providing the fertility, tempting though it is to send a team of professional British studs out there like a 21st century Flashman novel, but the service we offer is rather to mitigate the cost and inconvenience of having kids by taking them off their hands, not for hours, but for months and years at a time. This was the function served by British prep schools in the 19th century when we were the top dogs, and it was no coincidence that when half the mat was pink, the first thing any ambitious Brit did upon promotion was outsource his young. Today, this is the service we can provide to the IQ shredders of the East and hopefully keep their exceptional genes in play for posterity. Unless this sounds like I'm prescribing a somewhat subservient role for Britain in the great game, let me assure you, as Hitler, Antonio Gramsci and the Jesuits all knew, those who own the youth gain the future. Offer sanctuary to the offspring of the world's single-use burnouts, and the bond thus forged with Britain would be forged in fire. And crucially, as they eventually return home, it would allow us to disperse malevolent sleeper agents ready to be activated with a single phone call. I call it the Mancunian candidate. By the time they have completed their studies, they will have dated and probably been seduced by attractive young Brits, possibly government mandated. We'll see if it needs that. From my observations, I suspect not. They will have been suckered by maternal British matrons and landladies who will have filled the mother-shaped holes in their lives and converted them to that compelling ratio of sugar to grease in the British diet that they will struggle to find elsewhere. And they will have been inducted. They will have been inducted in the profound pleasures of being an elite in an old hierarchical tradition like ours, with proper pubs, cricket, and robotic district nurses cycling past the village green. They will be ours for life, reinforcing British cultural supremacy worldwide, just as the pre-woke shortwave BBC used to. What would be helpful, though, would be an ambassador for the profession and for the British offer generally. Ideally, an eccentric, a headline grabber in the Elon Musk mould. Someone willing to go on the world service and not only refer to Taiwan as a country, but to accuse Xi Jinping of deliberately looking like Winnie the Pooh in order to lure small children into his room. Few such initiatives and we could really put Britain back on the map, albeit a giant one covered in pulsating lights in the Beijing war room. As an export, education is carbon neutral, as the buyers have to do all the shipping from their end. And when it comes to transporting children, the wasteful use of excess packaging is very much frowned upon. Education has always been the thing that separated the great nations from the also-rans. True, as with Germany in the 19th century, too long a period of unchallenged academic superiority can lead to military overreach. But I feel confident that our fundamentally hesitant nature, in combination with the seemingly terminal weakness of our armed forces, will safeguard against such a thing. Now, some might regard this as cynical profiteering, but the truth is that private education, like the newly inflated university sector, has always been a racket. Always. Geneticist Robert Plomin has demonstrated through his analysis of twin studies that once you control for other confounding factors, private schools bestow much less of a benefit on the spawn of the wealthy than you might think. Less than good looks do, certainly, or being born in October, say. Less than not smelling of damp, certainly. And funnily enough, less than a childhood spent coping with some degree of adversity. But that's not the point. You actually send your kids to public school to encounter adversity. Boys at Eton develop the sort of emotional robustness and bruise resistance you can only really acquire when you're forced to wear top hat and tails on trips into Slough. Our most lavish gifts to the world all emerged from the crucible of our public schools. Soccer, rugby, cricket, buggery, hockey, all these were codified at school and shared through empire. Some would say that we are no longer a world-beating side in any of these sports, but that is to miss the point. The point is not to win the game, it is to create diversions to keep the lower orders fit and occupied, to keep morale up. That is our talent, the instinct of the officer class. And when it comes to universities, Oxford and Cambridge are always in the top 10 worldwide, often the top 5. It may not quite match their consistency in the boat race, but it's still quite something. All the rest, incidentally, are in the USA, which means we can grow this sector without attracting yet more Yanks to the United Kingdom. Meanwhile, only one of the top 30, Tokyo University, is in Asia. This is our market. The key, in my view, is to think big. Cambridge University and the Life Sciences Centre is already world-class, but with the vast emptiness of East Anglia on its doorstep, the capacity to expand could be mind-blowing. And the closer it gets to Norwich, the more the value of my parents' bungalow goes up. C Silicon Fen, a tiny slice of real estate which incredibly attracts about a quarter of all UK venture capital, is just the start. This could be the new fertile crescent of tech, the birth of a new civilization. The area is already defined, just as Mesopotamia was by the Tigris and Euphrates, by their tarmac counterparts, the A1 and the A11, or as the digital boffins know them, the A1 and the A3. Investment... Investment need not come from the public purse. As we discussed earlier in this series, we are all aware of the vast transfer of wealth to the new billionaires of late, whose gains map suspiciously well onto the overall losses incurred by wider society during the pandemic. Let's encourage them to endow some seats of learning to ease the tension. The prestige of the Hoover Institute at Stanford University in America could surely be used to tempt James Dyson to endow a rival in the UK. Now, it was in fact named for President Herbert Hoover, but that needn't obscure the bigger picture. And it might cost less than you think. Sagrada Familia in Barcelona, probably the world's most famous ongoing cathedral project, has only cost £1.2 billion so far. You could build a brand new university for that near Milton Keynes and call it Oxbridge to attract poorly researched custom. The same way that... The same way that the Japanese created a city called Yusa in the 1960s to trick the Yanks into buying superior foreign goods, thinking they were homegrown. The key, I think, is to offer our billionaires a way to give back without looking like they're capitulating, but rather continuing to build. And this brings me on to my next big idea, my other strategy to actually build back better, which is very much in harmony with the first. Tourism. It is time to give the world the version of Britain it really wants. By far the most successful country in the world at attracting tourists is, incredibly, France. France regularly earns as much as $150 billion a year from recreational visits, twice what we do, and this despite the fact that Paris is so disappointing it actually triggers a recognised mental disorder, Paris syndrome. I promise you, Google it. Essentially, a massive sense of letdown as the lies cultivated by the tourist board, fashion shoots and Hollywood of elegant models, cafe culture and jazz-playing cats proves illusory. Britain is far closer to its Hollywood image of Hugh Grant, dreaming spires, Dalmatians and the wrong trousers than Paris is. Paris has nothing to offer beyond what we do, give or take slightly lower rainfall, and a paralysing surplus of pointlessly minutely differentiated cheeses. Britain... Britain has billions in untapped tourist potential, especially now we are no longer bound by the rules of the EU Common Historical Policy, which so outrageously favoured the French and led them to think they could just serve shoe leather and frites for lunch every other day for 50 years and no one would dare complain for fear of being shrugged senseless. Let's create a heritage countryside once again, full of gingham-clad milkmaids, burly ploughmen, and rare-breed pigs. Not too full, obviously, or they just become pigs. Irregular fields... Irregular fields with trees growing in them, bustling hedgerows and haystack hookups. And would it really be that much effort to dye grey squirrels red? Or maybe just feed them something red, like flamingos? Let's create... Let's create town centres to match. Let's really market our unexampled historical offer. They needn't all be Victorian cobbled streets or toy shops with leaded glass and little black wheeled ovens selling baked potatoes and hot chestnuts. Some towns hit their zenith in the 1970s and could provide a really bracing immersive experience to visitors if they recapture that ambience. Leave your devices at home and plunge back into the Birmingham Bullring of 1977. Your kids can experience the joy of sulking without so much as an etch-a-sketch to occupy their thoughts. While you, their headscarfed mum, can perch on a stool, flicking through fabric swatches and brushing your player's number 6 ash off a pattern book. This would be a history lesson in itself. Other towns should play to their historical strengths. Instead of feeling mutely ashamed of its inglorious past, Bristol could attract coach parties of angry activists looking forward to a weekend tipping evidence of it into the docks. The statues themselves can easily be reproduced on a 3D printer, spattered with some authentic gull shit in time for the next batch the following weekend. They could even be made of compressed fish food to attract a healthy stock of salmon back into the estuarial waters of the Bristol Channel. My hometown, Brighton, has worked out that the key is to attract particular interest groups on particular weekends. Rallies are very popular, vintage cars, military ambulances, Harley bikers. Can't be long before a Sinclair C5 rally starts snaking its way down the A23. Though perhaps just the once. The one thing we no longer see in Brighton is the bank holiday mods versus rockers punch-up, having lost the franchise to Tottenham, I believe. But the new gender-based tribal wars are starting to warm up nicely, with running battles of trans versus TERFs looking promising. And, of course, there is something emboldening about being able to shout, "There they are, let's get them," even when you're only talking about a single individual. That, then, is my suggestion. for the future of Britain. Bring back the past. So finally, I'd like to take this opportunity to honour my father. Not a parson, but now 91, he has been a keen tinkerer all his life, and also a keen aviation enthusiast. We watched a lot of movies about aeroplanes when I was growing up, and if I wanted to paint a picture of the England I'd like to return to, it would be Leslie Howard as R.J. Mitchell in The First of the Few, reclining on the South Downs in a stripy blazer, observing seagulls wheeling and arcing through the skies, and being inspired not to heave a rock at them, as I am when I observe one of the buggers taking a dump on my car, but instead... instead to design the Spitfire and thus ultimately guarantee our liberty from the soon-to-be impertinent Hun. The hugely important aeronautical innovations that have been made in this country over the years have really been capitalised on, often for political or macroeconomic reasons, and their potential has instead been exploited elsewhere. The rare occasion on which our focus and commitment to seeing a project through has survived budgetary assaults has been in the build-up to and execution of war. And not just any old war, but war with Germany. Now, such a thing was unthinkable during our membership of the EU, and consequently our avionics sector languished, a mere fifth in the world. But now that we have just the tantalising prospect that such a thing could happen, and that we should at least be armed in readiness, I really believe we would once again rekindle the technological elan for which our boffins were once the envy of the world, and the pride of men like my dad. And would Germany be game? I'm sure we hardly even need to ask. Like him or know him, Boris Johnson has proved, as did Donald Trump, Leicester City, Susan Boyle and Bitcoin, that no one really has a clue what might happen next. No one. But if a comedy character lampooning the English aristocracy, created by a man born in America to a 23-year-old student of Cornish Turkish extraction and a 22-year-old left-wing artist descended from Lithuanian Jews, can become our Prime Minister, then really, what mightn't Britain become if only it wills it so? So, what have we learned? The secret to our future prosperity may lie in the humble shed, which means the only thing that can hold Britain back is arachnophobia. If Edwin Starr had managed to fit in a couple of years at the LSE, he may have penned the rather more economically literate song, "War, huh, what is it good for?" The sudden boost of economic output to a remarkable degree, granted that may well not be worth the suffering, but it's time for a little more depth in popular music. If you want to throw some leaves over the economic fallout from leaving a trading bloc, tuck into a bat or two. Not as unappetising as you think. Those wings are just perfect for dips. Thank you very much, and goodbye. You have been listening to Simon Evans Goes to Market. It was written and presented by me, Simon Evans, with additional material by no relation Dan Evans. The series was produced by Richard Morris. This is a BBC Studios production. And previous episodes and Simon